one we are dealing with Mizuho, and the other I'm trying to give you some kind of idea of what a Novi is. So we'll go a little bit further as far as this chapter is concerned, but not much further, to just bring you up to date. We have been dealing with degrees of Nebuah. The first is Nebo Velo Yoda Ma Nebo. We find that a person prophesies and he's not aware of it that he's prophesying at all, which simply means that we are aware, if you follow my Greek, of that of which we are not aware. That is that the human being is very deep, and he himself cannot penetrate to the depths of himself. But sometimes there is just a reflection of something that is very deep, and he notices it, and he's not even aware of it that he's noticing it. And we find this very often. And the two examples that I gave you are two examples that come in the Torah, where with Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was put onto the river in a box by his mother, and his sisters stood nearby just to watch what was happening, and Pharaoh's daughter goes around and finds him and takes him, and the child is crying, it wants to eat, and there's nothing to eat. And so Miriam, the sister, goes and says, should I bring the mother? And the princess says, yes. She brings the mother, and Pharaoh's daughter says, Haile Fi, which really means, take this, your child. Now, it wasn't her child. So, Rashi mentions there, she prophesied, but she didn't know what she was prophesying. She says to the real mother, take this child, take this, your child. She didn't mean that it was your child, not consciously, but deep down she felt that this was her child, the mother's child, and said, hey, you see, use that particular expression. Now, language is something that gives us away on various levels, even if there is something that we know deep down within us, it will come out either through unnecessary words that are said, or a slip of the tongue. Now, when it comes to Yaakov, when it comes to Yosef, you remember the story how he's waiting for his brothers to come, and his brothers, and he notices in the marketplace, he notices a brother, and he says, if one is there, they are all here, he knows them very well. He sees them all spread over, and then he calls them out one by one. And he calls them out by age and makes them stand in front of him and says, you're a spy. He said, you're not a spy. He said, you're not a spy. Then you belong to one group. Why are you hiding yourself? He said, because we are brothers. Since you're brothers, so you're coming together. Why are you coming separately? So now they've got to tell him, well, we were really, you know, we are 10 brothers. Yeah, but we are 12 brothers all together, and the one, the youngest, is with his father, and the other brother got lost once upon a time, and we are looking for him, we find him in Egypt, so we went to different places. See, this story doesn't ring true. You mean to say you're all brothers? So they said, yes, we are all brothers, sons of one father, all of us. So Rashi says, the second all of us was unnecessary. That is where speech gives one away. They prophesied, they didn't know what they were prophesying. They were including him. So deep down there was just that feeling. So that is the lowest form of prophecy. And we all go through that in some way or other. Got that idea? Just wondering if I can give you another example of that. All right. Now, the next form is Siyata d'Ishmael. Siyata d'Ishmael is we are helped And we all have got that experience. In retrospect, we see what we have done and we cannot understand why we have done it. We are not so clever. It wasn't our ingenuity. It wasn't our knowledge. What made us do this at this particular time, and it worked out so well for us? So that is Yahshua Ishmael, that is divine assistance, and divine assistance comes when we deserve it, it comes and we get it. For also, not really prophecy, but the next degree is already now. When it comes to Nebo, below Yodama Nebo, he prophesied but he didn't know what he prophesied, the person is completely unaware of it. When it comes to Yahshua Ishmael, the person is unaware of it, that he's been with. Sometimes he does something, and years later he works out to him, now why did I do it? Just look how things have worked out. It's worked out so well. But why did I do it? Only thing, the only conclusion comes to this was Yahshua Ishmael. He didn't realize it was Yahshua Ishmael at the time. One doesn't realize it. Now we come to the next level. The next level is Ruach HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh Kaplan calls it divine inspiration. It's not a very good translation, but I don't suppose you could find a better translation. Ruach HaKodesh is that one has a Holy Spirit. Now with Ruach HaKodesh, he's already very close to Hashem Yisroel. Very close. Ruach HaKodesh, he's fully aware of it that he's got Ruach HaKodesh. No doubt about it whatsoever. How does it express itself? In various ways. First of all, he understands what he understands with the utmost clarity. The second thing is what it is that he understands. He understands the secrets of the secrets of the universe, which we sometimes are not even aware of their existence. But that is something he has got the understanding of that. That is Ruach HaKodesh. Now he can't have Ruach HaKodesh if he doesn't know Torah. And Torah is a tremendous amount of work. And it's not only the Torah he knows, but it is how he knows the Torah. The depth of it all. And it's only after all that that he has Ruach HaKodesh. Now the Rechon of Asim had said about Rechon, it's time that he had Ruach HaKodesh, but he said only in his old age, when he was already an old man, he had Ruach HaKodesh, but not before that. Now the Rechon of Asim was a person who could testify that the Prophet Chaim had Ruach HaKodesh. And so we find people that have Ruach HaKodesh, and because of Ruach HaKodesh, can catch a glimpse of the future. We find that there were the great ones in Israel who knew before the Churban, before the Holocaust, that knew what it was that was taking place, what would take place. I think I told you the two incidents of my uncle when he gave the respite in London for the Prophet Chaim at the end of 1933, and he said that we are going to go through very, very difficult times, and it's the duty of every Jew to learn in your Rodeah, in the Shulchan Aruch, the laws of how one dies, one goes to one's death. If one is being murdered or massacred for no other reason than one is a Jew, is the way how one has to die. And that is an obligation we take now for everybody to do so. In 1940, when I came back to London, and I intended going back to Kells, I came to London and I had a Mesillah Shishori with me that belonged to the Yeshiva that I had borrowed from the Yeshiva. And I said to my uncle, I can't send it back now because there's no mail. The countries are all at war. I was in England, I thought they were listening to England. What should I do with this? So he took it and he lifted it and put it into my hands and he said, it belongs to you. You are the Yoreh. You have the empathy. I thought he was rather strange. You know, he's a language of character. He could have said to me, after the war, keep it, after the war you send him back. He said, you have inherited it. It was only afterwards that I realized what he had said. So we find that we have the great ones who have, or had, Ruach HaKodesh. After Ruach HaKodesh comes Nevuah. Now Nevuah is where a person has got an attachment to Hashem himself. It's as close as one can possibly come to Hashem. Now, Nevuah, when a person has Nevuah, he reaches perfection. Really, perfection is perfection, and there are no degrees of perfection, but we do speak of degrees in perfection. Perfection is a state, which is the highest state of all. And in perfection, there are degrees. And so we find that not all prophets are of the same degree. Some are on a higher degree, some are on a lower degree. Moshe Rabbeinu is on the highest degree of all. And that is what we did last week. We covered last week. He is on the highest level of all. Nobody has ever come so close to Hashem as Moshe Rabbeinu, perhaps the first man. And nobody is likely to come as close to Hashem as did Moshe Rabbeinu. Now those are the four levels of Nevuah. Now what I started doing with you last week was I wanted to show you what a Jew really is. Very difficult to tell you what a Jew really is, because you take the Jews of San Jose and you say, well, that is what a Jew really is. Or you go to Los Angeles and you walk down or up Wilshire Boulevard. You see Jews there. You don't see Red Indians, you don't see Hispanics, you don't see blacks. I'm speaking about just a special area of Wilshire Boulevard. Very fashionable. Jews. That's not what a Jew is. There's been such a deterioration. So, I've got to say what a Jew should be. But there are so few that are what Jews should be. So, I should perhaps say the ideal Jew. I don't want to say that. Because what is required here is not required of the ideal Jew. What is required of every Jew. And what is required is a tremendous amount. And it is that which we started discussing last week. And you remember, we discussed Leah, how when her first son was born, Reuven was born, she called him Reuven. And Reuven, see a son. So Rashi brings the Chazal, and Rashi says, what she said is, see the difference between this son of mine, the Reuven, and who is my firstborn, and the firstborn of my father-in-law. Who is her father-in-law? Yitzchak. Who is Yitzchak's firstborn? Esau. He says, now see the difference between my father-in-law's firstborn, which is Esau, and my firstborn, which is Reuven. My father-in-law's firstborn sold his right, his birthright, sold it to Yaakov. My firstborn didn't sell his birthright, but his father took it away from him and gave it to Yosef. Both of them lost their birthrights. Look at the way Esau behaved towards Yaakov. He sold him his birthright, knowingly, wittingly. And he wanted to kill him. He went back on it. He demanded the blessing from his father. He went back on it, and afterwards, when Yaakov got the blessing, he wanted to kill him, and Yaakov had to run away. Look what happened to Reuven. He lost his birthright to Yosef. When the brothers wanted to kill Yosef, he pleaded with them, put him in the pit rather. Why should we kill him? His intention was he would come back afterwards. He had to go back. They took it in turns, the brothers took it in turns to spend a week with their father, a couple of days looking after their father. It was his turn, so he went away with the idea he'd come back and take that gentle from the pit and return him to his father. When he came there, they'd already sold him to the Ishmaelites and he was gone. But that is what he wanted to do. It would have been to his advantage had he left that indefinite fully. It would have been to his advantage had he remained in the pit. Then he would have been the firstborn again. He would have been the before with all his privileges. Look what he did to save his brother. All love, no hatred. Compare the two. Now, if we were to speak in our everyday language with our everyday thoughts, we would say, as people do, the Goyim certainly say it, and I'm sorry to say that Jews behave just like the Goyim. And Jews say, what's the difference between a Jew and a Goy? There's no difference. And it's arrogant to say that a Jew is different from a Goy. What does the Goy say about Esau? That he's only human, that he hates. He hates Yaakov. The Jew says, human. Of course it's human. Of course it's human. He's now got the birthright. You find that sometimes a person sells another person a property and he sells it to him for a reasonable price. He doesn't make any profit on it, he might lose on it. 6 months later the property is worth twice as much. He hasn't got a good feeling towards the one to whom he sells it. But it's not his fault, he sells it. Yes, it is. I'm only human. That's not the way the Reuven behaved towards Yosef. That's not the way one is expected to behave. One is to be a true Jew, not good enough to be human. Got to be stupid. Otherwise it's not worth it. The whole of life isn't worth it. Just to be an ordinary human, it's not worth it. That is the demand that is made. Now, just we go a little bit further. And we'll try and understand just what it is to be a Torah Jew. And the reason I'm dealing this with you is that you should see what it is to be a Torah Jew, that you've got some idea of what it is to be a person with Ruach HaKodesh. These are just the ordinary people. This is it. What is expected just from the ordinary people. You know, there is the famous piece of Gemara, if the early ones are like angels, then we are like human beings, and if they were like human beings, then we are like donkeys. And not that other people think you know yourself. Which simply means that we've got to realize that it is not a question of degree, but it's a different category altogether. Not a question of degree, it's a different category altogether. That is what they were. And so when we see a person like Reuven, and a person like Esau, we can't put them into the same category. That is what it means to be a Torah Jew. You can't put them into the same category with a Goy. Just don't work. He's a Torah Jew. Can you put Reuven in the same category as Esau? Esav is human. Reuven is superhuman. That is what it means to be a Jew. And unless you are there, not only can't one have Ruach HaKodesh, one can't even appreciate what Ruach HaKodesh is. But let us go on a little bit further. I've worked with you from various occasions, the law of not taking revenge, not even barely a grudge. What it means not to have revenge, yes?
I'm not sure. You mentioned the bellows and the fellows and lending the bellows and lending the books.
Yes.
I wasn't quite sure when I heard the case brought about which one is revenge and which one is
the grudge.
Grudge. Yes, I wasn't quite
sure. Very simply, when the one dog sends his man to the other and says, ask your master to lend me this book from his library. He goes, and the other don says, I don't lend books, but if your master will come here, he can look at the book here to his heart's content. Fine. Now, the winter comes along, and the don who refused to give the book sends his man, who can't get his fire goes, to borrow a pair of bellows from his colleague, from the other one. If the colleague says, tell your master that I don't lend out bellows, if he comes here, you can use the bellows to his heart's content. That is the best.
But isn't that also a
Russian?
An evil person, because you...
I'm not defining the debt. That is the debt. To make a distinction between revenge and a grudge. But if he says to the man, he says, certainly, here are the bellows, but give this message to your master. Say to him that I am not as he is. He wouldn't lend me his book. And says, I must come and look at it at in his room. I'm not going to say I won't lend him my bellows. He must come and use it here. By all means, let him take the bellows. That's a grudge. He hasn't forgotten it. Lochito means forget about it, as if it's never happened. There was a man in London, I told you, who did my uncle a tremendous amount of harm. Tremendous amount of harm, and he's worked. And this man, after his uncle left down the West London, he went to his lawyer. This man fell on evil times. He became ill, he lost his wife, he lost his children, his children died. He fell on evil, lost his money. And my uncle used to write to him. And he used to go about in London and show the letters that Elia writes to me. Have a letter, here's a letter, showing the letters. No grudge, nothing. And he's heard me speak on the subject, no anger, no resentment, no annoyance, no irritability. That's what it means to be a terrorist. No irritability. It's not human, is it? Abby? It's not human.
It's not human. It's
Well, I want
to... incredible.
I want to tell you that in a few hours' time, your people can begin.
Okay,
and we've got the whole of Elul in front of us. You practice it on your husband.
Good idea.
Thank you.
Practice it.
No. Your husband never makes you angry.
No.
Your husband never annoys you. But if there are times, it might irritate you a little. And you just control yourself to be very
discreet. I'm always fine.
What's
that? My husband really is a pretty guy.
Yes, you're right. You're right.
Yes.
And if he never causes you any irritability, try to somebody else. But you truly find somebody. That is celibacy. That is expected of a celibacy.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yes?
Of
course, yes.
Where does not allowing yourself to be vulnerable to somebody who is person before? You know, I mean, I had a situation a couple years ago where someone just devastated me for over a very long period of time. And to this day, I love her, they don't live anywhere around here, but I really have no desire to be wherever that is.
Look, you don't have to have any
desire. I don't really make myself vulnerable.
You don't have to have any desire to be there, but the thing is, that person pulls them every time.
Oh, I wouldn't want that. I just don't want to be overwhelmed.
Yes, but it's not enough that you wouldn't want it. If you are the person that can help that person, you've got to help him. If you're the person that can help him, and I told you what happened at the turn of the century in Slobodka, when half the yeshiva broke away, they didn't want Jesus, and the great support of their students ahead, so they didn't have any money. So the principle of Slobodka yeshiva, that not a hill sprinkled. He supported them. Say, lady, he's not to support them.
Did he have sympathy for them?
Let us say there were 200 Jews. And 100 goes away. So now he's just got only to support 100.
Right.
But he had extra money. And they didn't have any money, so he helped them.
But that wasn't a case where they were trying to slow him down.
No.
It was just a different philosophy.
Yes, that's
true. It seems to separate more. I mean, if one is after and done,
I just want to tell you, and I'm telling you this, because it really doesn't worry me in the least. There was a certain member from another congregation who had to see me about a certain thing. And he said some remark, and I said, you know, it doesn't really matter. And he said, well, you know, there are people with us who don't like you. I said, I'm perfectly aware of it. I know that there are people who say, on no account must you go in there. In there means to other folks. I know that. I told you this. I know that. Even if you've got your child, you're not allowed to go in there. I said to this person, I know that. And he looked at me as if he was quite surprised. That's not a difficult thing to know. I said, I know that if anybody of your congregation comes to us and have a meal, you tell him immediately afterwards they're trying to get to these conversations. How can you go? You're a stranger. That's what they're trying to do. He laughed. I know that this goes on. It doesn't worry me. I know that this goes on. I know it goes beyond that. You know all this, that an important member of that congregation was invited to meet me at an occasion few people are getting together, not in our congregation, and making an evening for my wife and myself to meet some members of the community. He was invited. He served out the invitation. I don't mind. It doesn't worry me in the least. I'm not even irritated by it. But I just wanted this person to know. And I said, I know all this. So he said to me, well, you must know the history of your congregation. And that is, they broke away. And they didn't break away for ideological reasons. They broke away because they were satisfied with those who were constitutionally elected and all that. So I said, you know, we've got a concept with which we work. It's a Nalachi concept. And the concept is, Mikan ula mafreya ula habra. And that means, from now on, it is as if it has never been. You might have a fallout of the person. Good, but you make it up immediately. And from now on, it has never been. Unless the person perseveres as he or she has, or I've got to do it sometimes, because I'm going to teach the person. That's the way I teach it. I've no grudge, I've no resentment, but I've got to teach the person. Otherwise, the person never knows that there's anything wrong in what he's done. That's the difference, and I've got to do it. But nobody says anything about it. But of course, these things go on, but this is a concept you've got. You want to know why we come to this concept. Well, if you don't want to know, then I won't tell you. You do want to know. Now, it can, for example, if a person makes a vow, it is possible for him to have that vow annulled. He goes to a Bezdin, and the Bezdin listen to it and find out that they can annul. Now, imagine that a person makes a vow. A vow that he's never going to drink wine. And one day, his temptation is so great, it's a bottle of wine that he gets sent to him. Cost $20 a bottle, it's kosher wine. $20 a bottle. Or that he's not going to drink it, he's under a vow. He'll just open it and just smell the aroma. He smells it. You've never had one now. You just have a little. People come in, say, what do you do? Say, I'm just having a little wine. Well, I'll pour you out some tea. They say to him, pour out for us you can, but not for yourself. You are under the vow. Say, I can't restrain myself. Say, look here, we are warning you. Here we are two witnesses. That if you drink of this, we are going to report you to the Sanhedrin. This, and everybody supports him, comes to the Sanhedrin, he's got to be punished. He gets lashes for it. A week later, something happens, and now he decides he's going to a Chacham and to the Bezdin to annul the vow. He annuls the vow. And now it means it's completely eradicated. He says, this thing was never the vow. So what's the problem? So what's wrong?
If he got lashes for something that never existed.
Right, good. He means he got lashes for something that never existed. Never existed. So now it comes with. If many dreams are now, you can never give him lashes, because it's possible that afterwards he will do something to annul the vow. And that we know exactly this, how does it work out? So we say that when the Chacham eradicates the vow, it is from now onwards as if it never been. You follow? From now it is as if it has never been. That is the concept. Simple. Happened. That was 15 years ago, 20 years ago. I said to this person, 20 years ago, if you were a Jew, even if you're not a Jew, have you ever heard the term, let bygones be bygones? Have you ever heard the better term, let's bury the hatchet? Even a boy says, let's bury the hatchet. You can't forget it. From now on, it's over. Can't forget it. Well, of course it goes on. We know it goes on. But the thing is, we have got to be so isolated from that it just doesn't worry and it doesn't matter. Fine, some of you don't like us, so fine. What can we do? We love you. But how can you love us if we don't like you? excuse me, to tell that the Rahafter is that. The Rahafter, the Rahafter, the Milfi, must love your next one as yourself, and he loves you. Fine, doesn't matter. But that is the way to behave. Now, these people are doing us a great favor. They're putting us into a position where we can exercise this particular attribute. You know what it means? Imagine a person wants to play tennis, hasn't got a tennis court to play, and knows all the rules of tennis, hasn't got a tennis court to play. Somebody gives him a tennis court. He wants to swim. He's practicing for a exhibition, for a race. He's got to have somebody gives him. Yeah, we've got the opportunity. It doesn't matter. Excellent opportunity. But that is what is expected of us. Now let us go on a little bit further and we'll just see what happened. There was Hillel. Two men have a wager. They bet each other 400 zuzis. Now 400 zuzis was a tremendous amount of money. So they must have been wealthy people. That the one says, I will bring Hillel to a state of annoyance. And the other one says, I wager you 400 zuzis, you will not bring him to a state of annoyance. And it's Erev Shabbos. And everybody is busy on Erev Shabbos. So they go and they knock at his door, just go and knock at his door, and Hillel is in his bath. He puts on his robe and comes and opens the door. What's the matter? He says, why have Babylonians got round heads? Oh, says Hillel, the reason is because they never had good midwives. Children were born not having good midwives, thank God out there. Oh, thank you. Oh, nothing to thank me for. Hillel goes back into the bathroom. 2 minutes later, comes along again. Says to Hillel, why have the Chinese got slit eyes? He said, oh, that's a good question. The answer is because they live in sandy places. And they're always screwing up their eyes to avoid sand coming into their eyes. The result is that they have got slit eyes. Coming back a little bit later, asking a similar question. After he's seen that 4 or 5 times, and Hillel is not angry, he's not irritated either. And he's got to get out of his party side. He says to Hillel, may there never be many like you in Israel. He said, why? What have I done to you? He said, through you I've lost 400 zuzis. He said, well, and he tells him the story, he said, well, don't let that upset you. It's worthwhile losing 400 zuzis and twice that amount. And this is the way people should be. And then the Gemara draws its conclusion. La olam yerei odem anvosom nisom to Hillel. That is the title of the testimony. That is the conclusion of the Gemara. That is why it brings its story. It doesn't say, well, that was Hillel. Hillel was superhuman, but we are human. That is what we have to strive for. That is what we expect to be. Now, let us take a little bit further. Let us go back again to the story of Lavan and Yaakov. You remember, Yaakov comes to Lavan, and the people in Lavan's town know all about Yaakov. They know that when Avram wanted a daughter-in-law, he sent his servant to find somebody in their community. And it was Rivka who was found, and she went and was the wife of Yitzchak. And everybody knew that Rivka bore Yitzchok two sons, an older son and a younger son. And they used to say, well, we know what's going to happen. Yaakov has got two sons, and Laban has got two daughters. The elder son will marry the elder daughter, the younger son will marry the younger daughter. And Leah hears this thing over and over again. And by this time, the notoriety of Esau has spread, as has the fame of Yaakov. And she is going to marry Esau. She weeps bitterly, day and night. And so she has trouble with her eyesight. She has weak eyes as a result of that. And now Yaakov comes. Whom does he want to marry? Rachel. And it seems that she is destined for Esau. That's the last thing in the world she wants. And she says to herself that if he is the last man in the world, would I have to marry him? And so Yaakov is there, stays a month. And Laban says to Yaakov, you know, if you are my nephew, it doesn't mean to say that I'm a destroyer. You are looking up my, looking after my sheep. You've jumped a month already. Let us come to some arrangement. So Yaakov says, right, I will serve you 7 years for Rochel Bitefuad Tana, for Rochel. And then Yaakov speaks, I must know with whom I'm dealing. What do I do if you take a Rochel from the street and put it under the kippah? And said, you said Rochel, here is Rochel. He said, Rochel Bitefuad your daughter. For Rochel, your daughter. He thinks a moment. Laban is capable of giving Leah another name, and now she's Leah Rochel. And you put her under the coop, and you say, but she is Rochel also. That's also her name, Rochel. So he says, the younger one. Your daughter, Rochel, the younger one. Now this name is taken. In the end, he served for 7 years for Rochel. Leah is under the chuppah. He sees Laban in the morning, and Laban says to him, what's wrong? You don't anything wrong? He says, yes. He said, it wasn't Rochel, it was Leah. Oh, says Laban, I'm through. I am very through. You see, we, I don't know how you do it in your synagogue, in your place, I don't know how you do it, but we don't marry the younger daughter before the older daughter. Now, he could have said, and he should have said to him, Laban, didn't you know that when we made the arrangement? Didn't you know you so true? Didn't you know that you don't marry off the younger daughter before the older daughter? How could you have agreed to it in the first place? That speaking of quarrel, he doesn't say anything. He doesn't show any anger at all. Shows no annoyance. I'll serve you 7 years for Rochel. So he marries Rochel, and he's got his service another 7 years for Rochel. Afterwards, he served now 14 years, he's got nothing for himself. Now he comes to an arrangement, he wants something for himself also. The unlikely sheep, the spotted, the speckled, the striped, those are the ones that will belong to him. Agreement is made. After the agreement is made and he wants to go, Laban says to him, and he says, everything is mine. Your wives are mine, your children are mine, your sheep are mine, everything is mine. It goes on. That is what a Torah Jew is able to take it all. Yes?
Yes, but well, he's clearly taking advantage of him.
Yes, right?
I mean,
but you see, first place, he puts the layer under the chuppah. Done. he's not going to divorce Leah and cause her all that anguish. So right, it's done. So he's going to marry Rachel also. He marries Rachel. She doesn't start. It's not going to bring him any good. It's not going to do anything. So he goes on like that. And he gets out of it. Eventually he gets out of it. But nowhere do we find any sign of anger. Nowhere that he come and give him an argument, what is this that you have done? Nothing at all. Yes?
But when he took his wife out into the field and said, your father has, you know, treated me this yes. way, and he has done these evil things to me, and now we need to leave and go back to my land.
Yes.
They agree, but he did remember it.
Remember it, he did.
I mean,
from now on, does it has never been. Remember it, he did.
Oh, so
from now on, it is as it is has never been. Yes. In the end, it is Yaakov who comes up on top. In the end, he comes out on top. In the end, he's got all his children. In the end, he's got all his grandchildren. Well, I just want to tell you of a case that happened during the First World War. The Russians moved whole communities of Jews away from near the border of the Germans. These people tried to get back to their villages and to their towns. It was a dreadful time because they were so weak, there was no food, there was a famine, they turned out of all their lives. Anyway, this rabbi was a rabbi of Malak, eventually got back to Malak, and another rabbi was taken over. So this other rabbi says to him, if you want to fight, I'm ready for a war with you. He said to him, I don't want to fight. You don't want to give it over to me? Right? Okay. Then he went away. I met this rabbi. I knew his son. They were learning stuff of God again in the church. But he had a very good relationship between Sabbath and church, and we were always okay to live with us. We went to live with them. And one day one of his sons said to me, he said, you know, my parents lived all alone in Dakhlava. Now, Dakhlava was as big as this complex. That's a little bit smaller. So, you know, my parents are all alone there. You don't know what it is mean, and the train passes this little room down. You don't know what it would mean if you would just stop off and spend a little time with him. I said, of course I will. I said, I'll stop off and I'll spend a day with him. The whole state of life. I take the same train that comes the next day and continue my journey. So I got off and I went to see them. I came into the lobby. The lobby was the kitchen. That was the lobby. No floorboards. The stove was on the ground. I went in. There was one room that was divided with a curtain. The other curtain was the bedroom. There was his study and his and I came in, and then in that night I made a bed for me in that room, and I spent 24 hours with her. What a wonderful 24 hours that was. It was only years afterwards, when Daddy was in Cape Town with us, it was only years afterwards that a grandson of theirs spent some time with us in our home, that I discovered that the woman was a great grandmother or the granddaughter of the Lord. Didn't know it. But what a 24 hours I spent there. feel his sons, this man's sons, become very great. He's got grandchildren, great grandchildren. He's got great grandchildren. There was a time when he had two outstanding sons. Then this rabbi who took away his position in the lot sent him a message. You've got a son and I've got a daughter. Let us make a shidduch between them. And when everything is even, your son will take over the position and everything is all right. He said, that's not. And then he said, that's not. This son married an American girl. He was in Sabot, he was done in Sabot. He married an American girl and went to live in America. Now he's living in Israel. Escaped the Holocaust, he was saved. Another son, saved. A daughter and a son-in-law, saved. Everyone lost everything. That is the way. That is the type of Jew one has. Now, I'm telling you this so that you should get an idea. We can't understand what a person with Ruach HaKodesh is unless we've got this picture of an ordinary Jew. I'm just trying to bring you to that place that you can understand. Now, this is the first week that I've had a request that during the summer they should be this year. This is last week somebody came to me and said, you know, it's not right to have the women's shear during the summer. Look, we haven't got a full shear. The previous week somebody also came to me and said, you know, shouldn't have a shear on Wednesday night during the week, summer. You don't have a full crowd. Tonight, somebody came in just before the shear and said to me, why do you have a shear tonight? Why have you got a full crowd? Why are you having a shear tonight? So, I decided that next week I'm not going to have a shear.
Sorry, am I thinking
the lady's time? Well, I'll just give it to you short and then speak about it tomorrow afternoon. This means I think I told you many years ago there was an exhibition in the Johannesburg Library of Churchill's diaries. He was during the Boer War, he was a journalist in South Africa. So he took the diary. This is a very interesting diary. The first page, beautifully, beautifully written. Nothing scratched out. Second page. Third page, there was a word scratched out. first stage, couple of units. When you come to the second chapter, it was already, it was not that it was in the second chapter, a whole paragraph together. Then starts the next chapter, beautifully cleaning them. Hashem gives us this opportunity. Every month, there is a renewal. So there is the Erev Rosh Chodesh is a Yom Kippur in miniature. And there is a special service, a most beautiful service for Erev Rosh Chodesh, and it's called the Yom Kippur Kotel service. There is a vidui, there is a confession, of Rabbeinu Nissim. I've got a particularly soft spot for Rabbeinu Nissim because we come from the same country. He comes from North Africa, I come from South Africa. True. I'm afraid all comparison ends with that. But he composed this wonderful vidui, this wonderful confession, which we say tomorrow afternoon. Now, in the, there used to be communities which had it every month. In London, before the war, the great synagogue in London, they kept it up every month, there was a Yom Kippur Kotel service. Then the great synagogue was destroyed during the war, and they never revived it. In our congregation, we've got a Yom Kippur Kotel once a year. That's before Rosh Hashanah, coming to Bethel Hillel, you've got a Yom Kippur Kotel service. So that's the tip. It's in Talit and it's in Tefillin. So it's an ordinary afternoon service, an ordinary Minka service, with some Shlichos, not very many, some Shlichos, and this lovely vidui by Rabbeinu Nissim, this confession of Rabbeinu Nissim. Yes? You know, I'm always telling you stories. You know, I'm always telling you stories, but they're interesting things. If I had a colleague rabbi, Rabinovich is a very outstanding rabbi, a very outstanding man. And he was in the world with a lot of Israel. And he said, one day, he is in Petrusco Palestine, you see, and he had to walk somewhere. So he meets an animal, and he's going this way, you see, and the Arab is coming this way. So he says to the Arab, is this the way to that place? The Arab says, yes, so this is the way to it. He says, how long will it take me to walk there? The Arab says, walk. So he couldn't understand it, and he said, walk. He thought he just didn't understand it, was just rude. So he started walking. After he walked a little way, the Arab calls out to him, 1.5 hours. Why did he do that? Depends. I can't tell you how long it takes to take you. It depends on the pace you walk. I can't tell you how long it takes to take you. It depends on the person who does it. I don't know if it takes me to certificate. I can't tell you exactly how long it takes to take. It could take about an hour. Then of course we find it afterwards also, yes. It's an hour and a quarter. But really, if you've got to go, it's a beautiful service, all our services. If you've got Friday night service, our Friday night service, what a beautiful service it is. What a beautiful service that is. And we've got people that need that service today. They are superb. Jay, Hitzchok Walsik, Ezra Marsh, David Novitz. These are people that know how to lead the service. But Shimon next to Chad's kitty heart. I haven't quite got the news yet, you see.
Yeah, he's scary.
Chad killed the Chad's kitty heart. Hasn't quite got the news yet. Can you get it? Everybody get it, you child. I am completely out, you see. I don't even attempt it.
You
know,
Chad has a specialness.
Very advised. I mean, we sort of keep away from this sort of thing. But these are very beautiful services, yes?
Is it appropriate to bring some of the older children to young people cutting service, or are they seeing like some sticks on it, or are they still...
It depends on the parents, not on the children. You know, they're only, no naughty children, they're only naughty parents. If they're good parents, they can bring the children. If they're naughty parents, don't bring their children. That's all it is.
Well, where would one find this course?
You find it, you know, the invitations. You might even find it in the Oxford prayer book. That the way you will find it, with the beautiful translations, is there is a book of Sikhs, translated by Rosenfeld. We use it. You've got it. He came to see me once in South Africa. He phoned me and he said, Rosenberg, I want to come and see you. So I said, well, I'll go to a appointment. And he came up to see me in that living room, Young Avenue. He came up to see me and I just had one look at him. He wasn't an ordinary looking sort of person. I said, what is Rosenberg going to do? I said, that's the sleepers, right? And he said, yes. He did a wonderful job. It's really difficult stuff, and he's got notes there. And the notes are just right, just there. But you find it there. You find it, that's what you find. It's just a lovely service.
And the fast starts at sundown?
No, we don't fast.
Oh, we don't fast?
No. If you want to fast, you can fast, but I wouldn't advise you. Not easy to fast. No. There are people who are supposed to fast. In Jerusalem, we say it's a piece of fast, but this is not necessary to fast. All right. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you. This is the flyer for the Reverend's annual share, which was 1995. And so we learned to invite everybody to come.